So, give students experience of multivariable thinking. The world is a tangled place. Let them explore relationships among many variables. And you're saying, I don't know how I can add that to my existing course. They have some suggestions as to how you might be able to add it to an existing course. More on what they say, they need to understand the impact of confounding. Most textbooks, confounding is not in the index. This is a radical change. A radical change. Observational studies. Most textbooks, observational studies is not in the index. The t-test doesn't care if it's random selection from an observational study or random assignment from a clinical trial. It doesn't matter. These are radical changes, confounding observational studies. You need to do it in stages, scaffolding, etc. And you need to use simple approaches. And I think that's the most brilliant part of this guideline, is to come up with ways to do it easily and quickly. This change is, to be a Donald Trump, huge. It may be the biggest content change since the dropping of combinations in the 1980s. It's big. I don't consider randomization a content change. That's a means, a pedagogical method. This is a content change. It's radical. So, more on it. The world's complex. You can't do it in one or two variables. And they talk about the ASA 2014 guidelines that preceded this and talked about confounding variables. Great. What are the methods they suggest to show it? The first is something I thought of as mosaic plots. They've got a particular name for it. My problem is I just don't see this. I don't know. I'd like a survey. You know, I suppose I can see the probability here is greater than the probability here if I just compare these two. Maybe I can see it. Maybe you've taught me something.
They're not natural, but I agree.
Okay. Anyway, especially if this distance is wider than this distance, then it really gets bad. Then it gets to compare areas. It's like, oh, that's hard. So that was the first method they gave. The second method they used was to show how a relationship, the more teachers are paid, the lower the student scores. What's the solution to student scores if you want them to be higher? Cut teacher salaries. And then they go into the confounders, which has to do with the fraction of students. This is a tremendously difficult confounder. You have to know something about how geography and salary are related in the U.S. You have to know something about geography and the percentage of students that take a particular test. I would never use this example. It's what I call a two-part confounder. It's too complex. But the idea is a simple one, and there are better ones out there than this. Da-da-da-da. And this is the explanation, and it's complex. The third method they use is to just do a regression and show them the output. And you look at the slope on the Scottish Hill races, and the climb slope is 1.755, whatever that is. And then, if you bring in another factor, such as the distance of the rate, the climb slope changes. Now, I don't know that my students would see what was going on here, and they'd be mystified at all this other stuff facing them. I, as a teacher, on the other hand, might be just a bit concerned that the p-value on this intercept is not statistically significant. Do I want to call their attention to that? Well, I'm not supposed to. So I think what they're saying, they never said this in the guidelines, is assuming that all the assumptions are met, assuming that everything is statistically significant, just focus on that. That was their third recommendation. I'm not sure that's a good recommendation, and so I'll be asking you for your opinion on that at the end of this thing in a survey. But that's their suggestion. So my job now is just to communicate what they've given. And their concluding remarks, learn to identify observational studies, which is something in my regular course I don't spend any time on. But that's critical for this observational course. And this one's critical. They want to be able to consider compounding factors. They also ask for explain. And I think that is a doorway to a much harder area that they don't really take on, and I'll show you why. This is the brilliant one. use simple approaches such as stratification to show confounding. I'll show you. So, how can you possibly do this in your course? They suggest these deletions. Well, I don't do them. I've never done plots by hand. I don't know that that's going to save me a day in my class. But that was their recommendation. My statement is, it's impossible to do what needs to be done within the existing course. It's impossible. That's why a new course, a STAT 102 course, is needed. Okay.
Just a question.
Yes.
With your existing traditional course, do you still try to throw in these comments about, you know, if you're doing correlation, as you're doing correlation, the mathematics of it, say, oh, by the way, you know, correlation is not the same as causation, and say it, but you know that, like, you're really hammering it in.
But I do it with randomization. I do it with randomization because that's what that course is about.
I guess what I'm asking in general is, with this new course, are the concepts that you're really hammering in with a lot of good examples, are they at least alluded to, mentioned briefly in the traditional course, in the appropriate context, so that the person who's getting the traditional material, if they're, you know, swift enough at it, they would, you know, get at least some hooks into these issues, which are important issues.
I'm worried that I'm bringing too much of myself, because I love this other course, and I don't want to pollute the original course with Milo's stuff over here, so I've resisted that. There's something I consider even more important than that, and I do bring that in, and that has to do with being able to read tables and graphs involving percentages and percents and rates, knowing what's the part and whole, confusion of the inverse. So I do bring stuff in, but it's not as much on the causation-association distinction. It's more on the part-whole, invert, confusion of the inverse. If there were more time, I'd be the next thing I'd bring in. Because I'm also running an Excel course in this thing, and they're doing Excel assignments, so I'm pretty much maxed out. So what I want to do here is to show some other methods than what they presented. They certainly didn't say these were the only methods. These are methods that I have used. Two methods for showing confounding, but I want to say we need to explain confounding. Explain is what's needed for students to go away and say, I understand it. Here they can see it, but why it happened, I don't know. So let me go through the first two involving stratification. Here we have data on 20-year-olds. The average female, 64 inches, US, 129 pounds. The average male, 70 inches, 156 pounds. What's the difference in the average weights? 27 pounds. That's a fact. But students quickly realize this is what we call a mixed fruit comparison, an apples, oranges comparison. Men and women don't have the same average heights, and heights is connected to weight. And so if they had the data on women, 70-inch women, they might say, after controlling for height, by just pulling out that particular column, it's not a great math technique, you're just looking for the data, the difference shrinks to 14 pounds. This is probably the first time they've ever seen in math where a number changes after you take something into account. Where do we where do we run into it in math? Differential equations. A total derivative is different than a partial derivative. Can they have opposite signs? My students are not doing differential equations. But that's what we're doing here in a sense. We're saying that the uncontrolled, the total derivative, can be different than a partial after you take something into account. That's what I'm teaching is conditional differences by stratification. They can do the same thing with rates. These are death rates. And if I look at the total death rate for non-smokers, 31%. If I look at the total death rate for smokers, 24%. What does this tell us? If you want to live, smoke. Now the students know dimly there's something wrong here. And they don't have to be mental giants to say, well, what happens among the young? Oh, more likely to die if you smoke. What happens among the old? More likely to die if you smoke. What they're seeing is senses paradox. But I don't have to tell them that. I can just say, look at this. Can you see what's going on here? And they're basically stratifying by looking at a particular column. There's no math involved in this. It's just seeing it. This is the showing. Very effective, but I don't think the students understand why it's happening. And so that's why I want to move on to, well, the three problems. Does this explain? Can they work problems? Well, they can work yes, no problems. Does this reverse, da-da-da-da? But they can't work math problems. And in my experience, if the students don't work problems, they don't really get it. And I can't put it on the final exam. And if it's not in the final exam, they say, fine. So I'm saying, if that's all we have, I don't think teachers are going to spend much time on it. And students aren't going to remember it. So I've got three ways of showing it so students can see why and they can work problems. Number one is what I call explicit mixtures. Supposing I'm teaching a class with 100 students, 90 of them are advantaged by some criteria, and 10 are disadvantaged. And here are the average score for the advantage, here's the average score for the disadvantaged, and since there's 90% in this group, my average score is 89%. Now, there are other teachers teaching this section. My average score for the disadvantaged is higher than for any other section. I'm really good at working with disadvantaged students because my children are all adopted and some of them are disadvantaged, and maybe I'm better at that. The word gets out the next year, the next semester. Suddenly, I've got 50 disadvantaged students sitting there in my class. I try and improve every semester. So among the disadvantaged last, 80, this one, 81%. Among the advantaged, 90, 91%. I did better. And I'm working against the standard test that all of us are doing. What's my average now? 50-50, 86%. I'm feeling good. I did good. My dean calls me in and says, Shield, we noticed that your scores have dropped. What are you doing to improve? Students can see this. And what's the takeaway? What's the takeaway here? Because I think a student needs a simple story.
So do deans.
So, oh yes.
You need to finish that story. Did the dean learn?
So, it was better for each group, worse for overall. I can't say Simpson's paradox to my dean or to my students. They don't know that. But I can say, in three words, it's the mix. It's the mixture. And in most cases of Simpson's paradox, it's a change in the mixture. The students can see that. Oh yeah, the mixture changed. That's why your average changed. And I want to show this again and again. So after a while, they just say, oh, it's the mix. It's the mix. They've got a story, and they can carry that with them. So, Wehner, 2004, one of the most significant events up till that time in my teaching history was a graphical technique for showing how you could control for the influence of a binary confounder. I teach art and music majors, English majors. These are not quantitative giants. They can use this graphical technique to work problems, and they can talk about them. Now, I will say that a third of my students use this graphical technique. A third use algebra, and about a third do something in between, kind of proportional reasoning. I don't care which they use. And I don't try and predict. I teach all three, they choose. Here's how it works. On the vertical axis are death rates. Individuals are either in poor condition, they're over here, or they're in good condition. Poor condition means they're carried into the hospital, dragged into the hospital. Good condition means they walk into the hospital. It's very simple. And we have the death rates for those that are in poor condition and good condition. Everybody here is in good condition. We've got the rural hospital and the city. And we look at this, the city hospital death rate is higher than the rural. Which hospital do you want to go to? I want to go to the rural hospital. They have nice little nurses that give you tea and cookies in the afternoon. The city hospital, the nurses are overworked. They've got all these diseases. You can just get killed by somebody else's disease in a city hospital. We can do stories that explain anything. As human beings, we can beat a computer any day of the week on stories. But we're dimly aware that city hospital has a different mix. They have mainly patients in poor condition, whereas rural tends to have fewer. And we realize this is a mixed fruit comparison, an apples and oranges comparison. And if somebody knew what the average was for the whole group, we could standardize. Standardization was used by statisticians in the late 40s and early 50s before they had computers that would do regression. And I'm using the same technique now because it's simple. So, what I do is say, supposing that 60%, what we're doing here is changing the mix. We're not changing the death rates. Now, this is not Danny Kaplan's Bible. This is not really a model. I'm saying, but it is. A weighted average is a form of model. It's a fully saturated model, so it doesn't have a lot of the other things going on. This is multivariate regression with binary predictor and binary confounder. It's fully saturated. But this is really a three-dimensional. Anyway, we can talk about that later. But what you see here is a reversal. This is Simpson's paradox. Peter Holmes, after looking at this graph, said, Milo, this is the first time I've understood Simpson's paradox. And Peter knows more statistics than I'll ever know. But I think it's important that they see it and they understand it. They've got a story behind it, and it's solid. Now, whether they do the problem this way, I don't care. But there's a way to do the same thing with tables that I realized when I was presenting this talk. Take a look at this thing right here. I don't know why I don't have the top row circle, but anyway. Can you tell that 90% of this row are young? From this data? Yes, you can. It's one equation and one unknown. This weighted average of 24% is x percent of these plus 1 minus x percent of these. Solve for x, right? And you come up with 90%. 24% is real close to 18, right? The student with a little prep can see, oh, 90% are young in the second row, 74% are young in the first. There's a difference in the mix. And they can standardize by using what's in the third row, because that's everybody. 82% of row three are young. So let's use 82% on everybody. We're standardizing. We're doing the same thing the graph did without the graph. So I don't have time for the detail, but what I'm after are, can students work problems? Students work problems that show what it means to take into account a confounding factor. And I can put this on the final exam. Okay. So why don't they teach confounding? Number one, students will have less trust in statistics if any confounder can reverse an association. Do you want to be responsible for bringing our discipline into disrepute? No. I don't want to do that. Do you suppose students are going to be more cynical after they get this type of approach? If so, is that really what you want to do for your students? No. We're not subject matter experts. We don't know about confounders. This involves hypothetical thinking. It's induction. Confounding and causation, they're really not math anyway. We're not going to go there. And Pearson, a long time ago, said, we got burned by talking about causation with racial statistics. We should never go that way. Causation is a fetish among the inscrutable arcana of modern science. And I think that shadow has dominated our discipline with two exceptions. Yeah.
Oh, well, what are your exceptions in that one?
Yes.
Raise my own.
Yes. The first exception was random trials, Fisher. And we bought that one because that was good statistics. the second, which I consider the second most important contribution of statistics to human knowledge, was an exchange between Fisher and Cornfield in the 50s. The American statisticians wanted to say that smoking caused, in some probabilistic sense, cancer. They had a lot of auxiliary data. Sir Ronald Fisher, the number one statistician in the world, wrote a short article reminding his colleagues that association is not causation. Now, Fisher was a smoker. Fisher was not stupid. Fisher had data from a German twin study showing that fraternal and identical twins had different smoking preferences. He said, association is not causation. There could be an unknown confounder. I show genetics as a confounder, and I've got data. Anybody else than Cornfield, you may not know Cornfield, he's responsible for relative risk and the odds ratio, among a number of other things in epidemiology, replied. He replied. And he said, I've got a factor of 10. You've got a factor of 3. If you want to nullify or reverse my association, you have to have a confounder that's bigger than mine, and I can prove it. That's the first time anything on confounding had been proven. It was a theorem. Fisher never replied. We don't know why. I consider this minimum effect size is as important for observational studies as the randomized assignment is to the experimental side. Because this takes care of the student, it prevents them from becoming cynical. It's not like a butterfly in the Pacific can change every association. It's got to be a bigger factor. That's why effect size is important. That's why we ought to be teaching effect size. The bigger the effect size, the stronger the ability to ward off confounders. Yes?
Well, I'll just say, I still think that's a very strong statement that statistics educators don't teach confounding, and I don't know what context. I mean, Friedman and Pisani and Purves.
Can you name a second book? That's where I saw it.
A little more, McCabe did it, but even if it's just one book, it was an extremely, well, the second book, Agresti and Franklin, DeVoe and Velleman, my own book.
I've taught DeVoe and Velleman.
They have confounding in there.
Okay. I mean, Warren McCabe has, you know, there's two examples of it.
There's also the whole field of model selection.
I'm talking about an intro stat text.
Okay. So.
I just know Danny did a study of textbooks, and that's what he concluded. And no, yours wasn't one of the textbooks he looked
at.
Well,
but even so, I
think he did Agresti and Franklin.
Well, it's in there. I mean,
I'll have to look back on it. I'll get back to you, because I don't like to throw out statements that are really not true.
I mean, I agree there may be a matter of degree to how
No. It was weather, so I need to get back on that. Yeah. So, my students can look at this result without doing any math and say, you know, there's a 2 percentage point difference between the two hospitals, but there's a 5-point difference between good and poor. This is bigger than that. This passes the necessary condition. This could zero that out. It could reverse it. They can tell that just by looking at the outcomes, or they build this kind of a graph. Overall, 2.7% of hospital patients die. Here's what it is between city and rural. Here's what it is between poor and good patients. They can see, oh, that's bigger than that. And it doesn't matter whether you do as a difference or a ratio. It works both ways. So, they can tell, could this reverse it? Oh, yeah. They can see that in the data. And that, to me, prevents them from becoming cynical. So you can only reverse if it's stronger. If it's stronger. That's the main point there. The bigger the effect size, the less likely a confounder can negate or reverse. And that's why primary smoke, 10x. Secondary smoke, 1.3x. Statisticians are a lot more wary of this one because it's down in the weeds compared to primary. There could be other factors untangling that, etc. But our students don't get any of this, and I think they need to. Okay, so another 2-minute break, and while I switch and get ready for the...